When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The White House warns Russia could invade Ukraine within days, but at increasing cost to Moscow. Plus, as businesses snatch up temp workers, they're learning not every employee is created equal. And the U.S. prepares to unveil its long-awaited Asia trade strategy, but is catching up to China even possible?
China, its economy has been only growing, and also it is accelerating its economic policy diplomacy in the region.
It's Monday, February 7th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The U.S. has warned a Russian invasion of Ukraine could occur any day now. Officials familiar with U.S. intelligence estimate the conflict could claim the lives of up to 25,000 Ukrainian troops, as well as up to 10,000 Russian troops. White House National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan spoke to Fox News Sunday.
We have united the West. We have provided material support to Ukraine, all of President Biden's direction. And we have also offered Russia a diplomatic path if they choose to take it. If war breaks out, it will come at an enormous human cost to Ukraine, but we believe that based on our preparations and our response, it will come at a strategic cost to Russia as well.
Russia has dismissed the warnings as part of a U.S. propaganda war, while Ukraine's foreign minister has urged the public not to believe, quote, apocalyptic scenarios. Nearly 2 years after sealing its borders to international travelers and many of its own citizens, Australia plans to reopen to the world starting February 21st. There is a catch. Travelers will need to be double vaccinated, a rule Prime Minister Scott Morrison said anyone who followed tennis star Novak Djokovic's deportation last month should already be aware of. This comes just days after New Zealand announced a gradual reopening of its tightly sealed borders in the coming months. Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai has given her first interview to Western media since an allegation appeared on her Chinese social media account saying a government official had coerced her into having sex with him. Peng later denied having accused anyone of sexual assault. She met with International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach in Beijing this weekend amid continued controversy surrounding her safety. During a press briefing, spokesman Mark Adams was asked whether the IOC believed Peng was speaking freely during her meeting with Bach.
We, as a sports organization, are doing everything to ensure that she is happy, and I don't think it's up for us to be able to judge in one way, just as it's not for you to judge either in one way or another her position.
Chinese government officials have previously said they are unaware of any sexual assault allegation. And the Joe Rogan backlash continues for Spotify, as CEO Daniel Ek has apologized to staffers after it emerged that Rogan had used a racial slur in previous podcast episodes. The letter to employees explains how Rogan has removed some episodes from Spotify following discussion with the company and his own reflections. Tracking site JREMissing.com says 113 of Rogan's episodes have been taken off of Spotify since Friday, though X says he has no plans to remove the podcaster from the streaming platform. And we should mention that Dow Jones, the publisher of The Wall Street Journal, has a content partnership with Gimlet Media and its parent company, Spotify. An urgent need to fill holes. That's how many American businesses are describing their recent push to snap up temp workers as employees called in sick in record numbers last month. And until COVID-19 cases subside, it could be a while before companies can return to cheaper and less disruptive staffing patterns. Here with a look at what big businesses' embrace of temp workers means for their bottom lines and for the labor market as a whole is Journal Markets editor Quinton Webb. Hey, Quinton, welcome.
Hi there.
How marketed is this shift to temp workers by American businesses, and why exactly is this occurring now?
It's pretty striking. So in some cases, companies are telling us that they're using twice as many or four times as many temp workers as they did before. You know, the labor market is very tight, so people are moving to other jobs. There's been this kind of string of departures as people have reassessed their priorities during the pandemic. And then on top of that, there's been this wave of absenteeism in January in particular due to Omicron. In some cases, people have said that as many as 40% of staff might be out sick, either because they themselves are affected or because they're looking after others. We know across the American economy in early January, 6% of all staff were out for those kinds of reasons.
And what impact is this high utilization of temp workers having on businesses?
Well, it has, if you like, a financial and an operational impact. On the financial side, it's generally more expensive because, not least because you have to kind of pay a temp agency in the middle to find the staff for you. And then on top of that, you know, these are people who are less familiar with your business, so they need extra training. They're more likely to kind of make rookie mistakes. And so it generally kind of slows down the operation of the business.
Right. And it's not just the fact that companies have to hire temp workers. It's that this overall absenteeism we've been seeing is probably dragging down profitability too, right?
Yeah. In some cases, businesses are just unable to meet all of the demand that's out there. So in some cases, they're having to curtail their hours, work shorter hours because they just can't find the staff to keep the restaurants open or keep the plants running as they would like to.
That was Journal Markets editor Quinton Webb. Quinton, thanks for the update.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, the U.S. is due to unveil its first economic strategy for Asia in half a decade. But after ceding ground to China and with weak support for free trade deals in Congress, how much ground can the U.S. realistically make up? We've got that story after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
The Biden administration is putting the finishing touches on its long-awaited strategy for trade and economic partnerships in Asia. It's to be known as the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, and to many in the U.S. government, it's an urgently needed intervention that constrains China's growing economic dominance in the region. Yuka Hayashi is a trade reporter at the Journal's Washington Bureau, and she joins us now to discuss what exactly the administration is cooking up. Hi, Yuka.
Hi, Luke.
Why is it so important that the U.S. has an economic strategy in Asia right now?
China, its economy has been only growing. And also, it is accelerating its economic policy diplomacy in the region. It has recently applied to join the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was a trade agreement that was designed by the U.S. as a counterweight to China. It is also leading this new huge trade agreement in the region called RCEP, which includes China, of course, but a lot of U.S. allies like Japan and Australia. And this trade agreement just launched last month. The U.S. pulled out of the TPP in 2017. And since then, we haven't had a sort of broad economic strategy for the region. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has done a lot to reinforce the U.S.'s already very strong military presence in the region. So there has been a gaping gap for broad economic policy when it comes to the Asia-Pacific region. China's influence is only growing, and their eventual participation in these groups will give China the leadership in setting standards and policy, particularly for emerging technologies, artificial intelligence and 5G. And that is the concern that a lot of U.S. businesses have been discussing.
So what do we know about the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, this new U.S. initiative so far?
We know actually very little about this. President Biden unveiled the idea for this framework late last year during the East Asia Summit. It's a broad agreement that will cover issues like digital trade, supply chain resilience, and decarbonization, also labor standards. But beyond that, for now, we know very little.
So, Yuka, which countries is the U.S. hoping it can attract to sign on to this new agreement?
So the goal is to sign on as many countries as possible, but it may be a little bit difficult, at least in the beginning. And it is likely that the framework is going to launch with several countries that are already the U.S.'s closest allies, the usual suspects: Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, probably South Korea. The challenge is whether the U.S. could recruit countries in Southeast Asia like Indonesia and Vietnam.
And why is it that Southeast Asia in particular is so important here?
Countries like Australia, Japan, they already operate on rules and values that are very similar to ours. But you look at Southeast Asia, countries like Vietnam and Indonesia, they are relying increasingly on trade with China. And so they would obviously would like to maintain close relationship with China. But at the same time, China comes into these countries and using their strong economic ties, start setting rules and standards for technology, digital trade. So that is the concern.
Is it clear what could get countries like Vietnam, Indonesia to be more attracted to this deal? It seems like that's a pretty large missing piece here.
So the Biden administration is in a very tight spot here. The reason for that is in traditional trade agreements, the main features are market opening steps, particularly tariff cuts that will make countries give U.S.'s trading partners better access to the U.S.'s huge market of agricultural products or manufactured products like autos. But the Biden administration is not in a position to offer those measures because there isn't a lot of domestic support for those measures in Congress. There's a concern that traditional trade agreements have been a bad deal for U.S. workers. They led to job losses. So there are a lot of lawmakers from both parties who are against those measures.
All right. So it sounds like there isn't broad political support for this trade deal. But besides the administration, is anyone else lobbying for this Indo-Pacific economic framework?
So business groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce have been pushing the U.S. government to return to the TPP. But they also realized that the domestic political situation doesn't allow that. So they are pushing for a digital trade agreement, and they want that to be a big part of this new economic framework. And the reason why they're doing that is they really would like to make sure that the U.S.'s technology industry will maintain its leadership. And they really would like to avoid a situation where China really dominates in making of rules and standards for the coming years.
That is Journal reporter Yuka Hayashi. Yuka, thanks so much for bringing us this story.
Thanks for having me.
And finally,
you're looking, it's beautiful, lots of stars, bright blue, blackness of space, and then this white line cuts through it.
That's Journal science reporter Aylin Woodward describing the increasingly common appearance of a SpaceX Starlink internet satellite when scientists point their telescopes toward the heavens. SpaceX is now equipping its newer satellites with visors to reduce their perceivable brightness. But Woodward says as space becomes more crowded, satellites from SpaceX and its future competitors will increasingly keep on photobombing the work of scientists.
The chance of a Starlink satellite streak sort of occurring at that very point in an image where the astronomers want to look and the object that the astronomers want to see is, that's like less than 1%. However, the problem is that we're at 1,500 Starlink satellites right now, and we're going to increase that almost by an order of magnitude to about 12,000. And when that happens, the problem might get a little bit more tricky.
And that's What's News for Monday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.